Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
For those of us old enough to remember 1979, the sounds from Iran sound a little familiar. 30 years ago, the people of Iran rose up to oust the Shah, and Iran became an Islamic republic. Today, protesters in Tehran shout, "We will fight, we will die, we will get our country back." And it has us wondering, is this the beginning of the second Iranian revolution? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Actually, today it is Celeste Headlee and not John Hockenberry, but Luca Burbank, who's filling in while John is away. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. Let's get right to the top stories we are following on this Tuesday morning. Reassuring words from President Obama.
The American people should be assured that we are doing everything in our power to keep you and your family safe and secure.
At the airports, passengers are increasingly being patted down and carry-ons checked and double-checked. Canine teams are out in force, and international flights now have more air marshals mixed in. But a report this morning from our partner, the New York Times, says there are gaps in that security. It says the government has yet to find a way to efficiently match passenger names with terror watch lists. The Times also reports millions of dollars was squandered on faulty technology, like those high-tech puffer machines that repeatedly broke down and failed to detect explosives.
Another issue in the airline security problem is the question of profiling. Many civil liberties groups say it's not fair. But Congressman Peter King, the ranking member of the Homeland Security Committee, tells the Today Show profiling should be a reality.
To me, it's not kidding anyone. We're just living in a politically correct world to say that we should be screening a Scandinavian grandmother the same as we do a Middle Eastern male.
King says it only makes sense for the U.S. to focus on locations with high Muslim populations. In Iran, the authorities are holding the bodies of five protesters killed during the anti-government protests on Sunday. It's an attempt to keep the opposition from using the funerals for more protests. Yesterday, President Obama condemned Iran's tactics.
The decision of Iran's leaders to govern through fear and tyranny will not succeed in making those aspirations go away.
For more on that, we're joined now by Hamid Dabashi. He's professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. Hamid, you were part of the protests in Iran in 1979. And so when you see these protests now, today, on television, do they look familiar to you?
Well, there are many similarities, but it's a whole different ballgame. When you see Mr. Mousavi, aging, seasoned revolutionary, and a young protesters in the streets of Tehran, think of an aging football player coaching his son or daughter who is a soccer player. There are many gestures in the field, but it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, do you see a strong opposition leader emerging, Mousavi or perhaps someone else?
Perhaps yes, perhaps no. But the fact remains that the movement is a civil rights movement. It will need a leader, but multiple leaders will do.
Hamid Dabashi, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
In Afghanistan, a provincial governor says a U.S. airstrike killed 10 civilians. However, NATO is denying that charge. And in Pakistan, the authorities in Karachi are appealing for calm after yesterday's bombing against a religious procession in Karachi, left over 40 dead. That also sparked riots throughout the city. Checking the markets, Asian markets ended up with European indices up as well. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow gets underway shortly at 10,547. The S&P opens at 1,127. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,291.
It's Tuesday, and that means that we're going to be talking about work on The Takeaway. If you are out of work, this may be an opportunity to think of it as an opportunity to make a fresh start. Don't buy it. Well, we're going to talk about that a little later this hour. And today, we're also talking about New Year's resolutions. I have one, and we're going to be following my New Year's resolution to get
That's
to,
brave
out of,
of
debt,
you.
Right?
That is brave of you to
but
lay
it
that
also
out on
keeps
the
me on track, doesn't right. it? But we're asking our listeners today to make a New Year's resolution for the country, for America. What should the country's 2010 resolution be? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I think it should be eat more vegetables. That's my vote. Coming up, more on the protests in Iran and how they compare to the revolution in 1979.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, and I'm here with Luke Burbank. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, Celeste.
I don't know if you remember, Luke, the Iranian Revolution of 1979. I was 9 years old at the time. But over the weekend, we got news out of Tehran of Iranian authorities arresting a number of prominent opposition figures. At least 8 people are dead in the past few days. That's the latest in a series of recent protests since the disputed elections that happened over the summer. And if you remember those, the news coverage of the revolution in 1979, it may seem reminiscent of what was happening then. That was a string of protests that ousted the Shah and ended up putting the Ayatollah into power.
And for the first time since violent anti-Shah protests began in Iran more than a year ago, there were celebrations in the streets of Tehran.
The Shah's departure made Ayatollah Khomeini, in effect, the new ruler of Iran.
That Iranian revolution took a year to culminate, and people are wondering now, are we seeing the seeds of a new revolution? So to answer that question for us, we have the former head of the BBC's Persian service, Bakr Moyn. He wrote a book on the 1979 revolution called Khomeini, Life of the Ayatollah. And joining us again, Hamid Dabashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning to you,
Celeste. Hamid, let me ask you, you know, the original revolution that you were a part of did take more than a year. Are we seeing the seeds of that going on in Iran now?
Not really. You were 9, I was 25, and the things were slightly similar but entirely different, because the objective of the movement at the time was simply the fall of the Shah and return of Ayatollah Khomeini. That is, you had a charismatic leader leading the revolution, and you had a despised dictator that people wanted to get rid of. This is not a scenario anymore. This is a far maturer society after its civil liberties. For the first time in the history of modern Iran, people are out in the streets asking, where is my vote? This is how this movement started. Against a political culture that historically asked the question, where is my gun? And that is a seismic change that has happened in Iranian political culture, not only over the past 30 years, but over the last 200 years. So there are fundamental differences.
Bakr Moyn, would you agree with that? You covered the 1979 revolution.
Absolutely. I think Professor Dabashi is right. It's about citizenship. It's not about charisma. The population of Iran is twice as much. Their people are better educated and better informed. I think they want their rights. They want democracy. They want a movement towards a much liberated society from religious dogma, as well as the conservative tyranny that has been brought about by Ayatollah Khamenei as some of his aides in undermining all institutional democratic institutions in Iran. For that reason, we don't have a charismatic leader like Ayatollah Khomeini, nor the wide variety of mosques that they were at disposal. Nevertheless, is a social movement that is going ahead slowly but surely and deeply.
Well, the question then is, can this social movement succeed without some form of overthrow of the government? And certainly, Hamid Dabashi, there's no template for a revolution. Every revolution is its own individual and unique animal, right?
I agree, Celeste, but also keep in mind that success can be defined differently. As Mr. Moin just told you, right now this struggle is for civil liberties, and already the public space, whether we are talking about internet or the streets of Tehran and Shiraz and Isfahan and so forth, have been appropriated by the demonstrators. And they are the initiators. They initiate change, and the government has to respond. And they have pushed the government of Ahmadinejad, and even beyond that, the entirety of the regime, to a position that if they yield, they lose. If they attack, they lose. What the end result of this might be is an open question. It might be eliminating the figure of Vali-e-Faqih from the Constitution. It could be reconvening of the Constitutional Assembly. It could be putting the entire notion of an Islamic Republic as a referendum, as a plebiscite. This is all open and remains to be seen. But the fact that a population has matured, 80% of the Iranian population is under the age of 40, 50% is under the age of 25. They neither have a memory of the revolution of 30 years ago, nor could they care less about those who do. It's a whole different ballgame.
Well, Bakker-Moyn, the government has been cracking down. You heard Hamid Debashi talking about how the government loses no matter what it does. And, you know, obviously they've been ramping up the government response to these protests. We heard that the nephew of Mir Hossein Mousavi was killed. His body was confiscated. Five bodies of protesters were confiscated. And they're ramping up their response. Is Ahmadinejad eventually perhaps going to have to step down?
Well, that would be one option, but I think before that, really, we have to have more democracy within the current constitution. I think what would happen is that there are extremists within both camps, but the main body of the reformist camp and the Green Movement, really, they want more democracy within the current setup and push it forward in order to reach full democracy. I don't think it's a political movement to change the regime and suddenly we have democracy. No, it's about democracy and it may take longer. And the longer it takes, the more mature the whole situation would become. Naturally, there are hardliners within the government who want to radicalize the other side in order to clamp down and justify it. And I think Ayatollah Khamenei's position is really depends how he manages to survive within the whole thing. But nevertheless, as a whole, the opposition is now gradually finding its voice and positioning itself for a longer period rather than a quick success.
Well, let's talk about that success. Hamid Debashi, what are the chances for success in this fight for civil rights in Iran?
I think the chances are absolutely excellent. And already, 6 months into the operation, I recall it was almost 4 or 5 months ago I was in your show. The momentum has sustained itself. The people are using any occasion to pour into the streets and redefine the political scene. The reason that the government now is into the business of snatching bodies, because it is afraid that the funeral processions will be used for further demonstrations. But it's a useless attempt, because it doesn't matter what occasion the demonstrators they use, they will use it. Right now we are in the month of Muharram, which is a religiously charged month. But it doesn't matter. A few years, months from now, we will have Iranian New Year on the solar calendar, and it will be the same thing. The point and purpose of the demonstration for the last 6 months has been to come to the streets, demand and exact civil liberties. Article 27 of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic grants citizens permission for peaceful assembly. It is the government of the Islamic Republic that is in the violation of its own constitution, rather than people who have been systematically and consistently asking for permission and not been given those permissions. So their coming into the streets is simply exercising their constitutional rights, which they have not been able to do over the last 30 years.
Hamid Debashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. He was part of the protests that led up to the 1979 Iranian Revolution. And Bakker-Moyn joining us, former head of the BBC Persian Service and author of the book Khomeini, Life of the Ayatollah. Thank you to both of you. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
The top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee says the government needs to do a better job of telling Americans about the threat from terrorism. Michigan Congressman Peter Hoekstra says the U.S. needs to be, quote, more forward-leaning in its approach and needs to put the latest technology for dealing with aircraft terrorism in place. He says a system for preventing a terror attack on American aircraft failed when a Detroit attack was thwarted on Christmas Day.
Overseas, the death toll from yesterday's suicide attack on a Shiite Muslim procession in Pakistan continues to rise. Officials in Karachi say at least 43 people have died. Authorities are appealing for calm as rioters set markets and shops on fire across the city. And finally, Wall Street is reporting cautious gains as it prepares to close the books on 2009. As of Monday, the Dow is up just over 20% for the year, the S&P 25% and the NASDAQ 45%. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, recent flight worries, they're not just bad news for travelers, they're also bad news for the airlines who've been struggling as it is. We're going to talk about that in a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
It is a takeaway. I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry here with our takeouts on stories we're following this week. Let's start with a takeout on air travel. In the wake of Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab's alleged bombing attempt of a Northwest Airlines flight, we want to know how the business of air travel is actually being affected. Here to help us with that is Robert Mann, an airline consultant and president of RW Mann and Company Incorporated. Robert, everyone complains about the hassles of the increased security stuff, but do people really actually cancel flight plans because of that hassle?
this week, I don't suspect you'll see many, given it's the leisure travel week. Business travelers, however, might be a different story.
Is there anything that airlines can actually do about that? Because they don't really get you until you've kind of run that security gauntlet already. I mean, can they add incentives or something so people will put up with the hassle?
I think mostly what they've done is quietly lobby to have some of the more ridiculous restrictions lifted, and it appears that's been successful.
Are they? Do they play any role in what happens with the security stuff, that TSA thing? I mean, do they get to have a vote in that process?
They really don't, except that they quietly lobby to eliminate the most anti-productive aspects of it.
Business-wise, what was the outlook, you think, for airlines before this attempted bombing, and what is it now, in your opinion?
Well, I think fundamentally, from an economic growth perspective, quite positive. From an energy cost perspective, moderating, but we're always subject to these external geopolitical factors, and that may win or lose the day.
Robert Mann, airline consultant, president of RW Mann and Company Incorporated. Thanks.
And now for our value takeout with takeaway correspondent Farai Tudeh. It's part of the ongoing series, The Value, What Matters to Us Most. This series looks at the moral choices that people make in the face of these tough economic times. Farai is back with us now with her latest story, which she found while she was in India last month. Good morning, Farai.
Hi, Celeste.
First of all, what were you doing in India?
I was there for something called the World Young Leaders Conference, and so a group of international folk got together and we toured NGOs and businesses. It was fantastic. It's an amazing country.
And you met an amazing person while you were there. Tell us a little bit about this entrepreneur that you met.
Yeah, his name is Umesh Malhotra, and he's the founder and CEO of something called Hippocampus Learning Systems. And this is a foundation that encourages children in India to read. He had this tech career. He went to Silicon Valley with his family, got to see some great libraries, came back, found that there weren't adequate libraries in India, and he made a big career change. Here's how he says he's moving into the education field and how it's changed his life.
This world which I'm living in seems to be a lot more fun and exciting, a lot more challenging than a world where you measure your success by where you went for holiday, which class of aeroplane you travel in, and where you stay.
So he had a career in technology, and he gave that up to do what exactly?
Well, he actually founded and sold a company. He was very successful. So what he does is he creates high-end libraries for rich Indian kids, and then he founds nonprofit libraries for kids in the slums and the villages, and he's reaching hundreds of thousands of people.
So what do you learn from someone like Umesh?
Well, he really loves being someone who values things other than making the biggest buck. He founded this company with his wife. It is a spiritual path, you could say, for him. And he said that whatever financial success he's had, it never helped him find meaning in life. Here's more of Umesh on that.
I was an entrepreneur, and when I talk to a lot of people today working in such fields, I realize that many of them are not truly happy. They're still constantly looking for meaning. I do meet a lot of people, but now they're different people. They desire to work with the poor or work with the disabled or work with healthcare. They are searching for meaning.
They're not searching for meaning. They found it. That's Umesh Malhotra speaking to Farai Tudeh for our series, The Value. As always, there's a really great web video for that story. You can check that out at thetakeaway.org. And you can actually see all of the segments that Farai's done on that series there. Thanks so much, Farai. For our next takeout, we go to our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. He is hot in the middle of his series on the most memorable sports stories this year. Right, Ibrahim?
Correct.
And today you're going to talk about the University of Connecticut's women's basketball team.
You gotta love the UConn women's basketball team, and I tell you why. Not only this year, they won their sixth national title. They had a 39-0 record. They won their closest game. Their closest game was by 19 points. Their average margin of victory was 25.2 points. And they had forward Maya Moore. She was the first rookie, man or woman, who was selected as the Big East Player of the Year. They were a dominating team, and they took the women's basketball by storm this year.
If for all those people who think that watching women's basketball is not exciting, the women's UConn basketball team kind of puts the lie to that.
It's true. Maya has this ability. She wants the ball at the end of the game. She's hungry for the ball, and that's how you know a great player. And she also has a good 3-point shot, and she's really tough. And that's what typified this team. They were tough when it mattered most.
Let's listen to a little bit.
Their 15th tournament title. and fourth in 5 years. A resounding 75-36 victory.
They are the Huskies are the first college basketball team that's men or women to finish the season unbeaten with every win more than double in the double digits in terms of the span.
And this year, they're starting out the season. They're undefeated still. They haven't had an opponent score over 68 points. Most of their opponents score about 35 to 40 points, while they score in the hundreds or like the 90s or 100.
At what point do they have to start playing with four players?
That's a great question.
Well, I think that's a question for those who lose to them, actually. That's probably what they're wondering. Thanks so much, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We're going to continue with your most memorable sports stories of the year coming up. But also coming up later this hour is, remember we were worried about more than just terrorists in the skies?
You're in a confined aircraft. When one person sneezes, it goes all the way through the aircraft.
That was Vice President Joe Biden talking about how he got nervous when people sneezed on airlines because of the swine flu. It was not quite the pandemic that we expected. Looking back at swine flu, what we did right and what we did wrong in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
It is The Takeaway. I'm Luke Burbank, in for John Hockenberry. Thankfully, Celeste Headlee is here. Hi, Celeste.
I am. Good morning.
Coming up, it was the pandemic that wasn't. We're going to talk swine flu and what we got right and what we got wrong. That's in a few moments. Right now, though, let's check in on the top news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A group calling itself Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has claimed responsibility for Friday's failed attack against an airliner bound for Detroit. The internet statement claims Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib coordinated with the group while in Yemen. President Obama says the U.S. will go after them.
A full investigation has been launched into this attempted act of terrorism, and we will not rest until we find all who were involved and hold them accountable.
We're seeing increased security at airports with passengers increasingly being patted down and in high number of air marshals on international flights. This morning, Congressman Peter King, the ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee, tells the Today Show that it makes sense for the U.S. to focus on locations with high Muslim populations.
Listen, if you're going after the mafia, you go into Italian communities. If you're going after the IRA, you go into the Irish community, the Irish bars.
He's
going
to get emails. The two federal agencies charged with keeping terrorists off planes and out of the country still don't have leaders. President Obama's nominees to head the Transportation Security Administration and Customs still have not had their confirmation hearings. The president took 8 months to nominate them, and then health care took over much of Congress's attention. And Ponzi schemes are having a rough year. FBI statistics show in 2009, more than 150 pyramid schemes collapsed in the U.S. That's compared to 40 the year before. Quick check on the markets. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,547 and the NASDAQ at 2,291. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Hey, Celeste, remember this?
I would tell members of my family, and I have, I wouldn't go anywhere in confined places now. It's not that it's going to Mexico, it's you're in a confined aircraft. When one person sneezes, it goes all the way through the aircraft. That's me.
Joe Biden.
Who can forget?
He tells it like it is.
Long ago, it seems like a long time ago, maybe in a galaxy far, far away. Really, it was March of 2009. We were just getting to know the term swine flu after there were some mysterious flu-like cases down in Mexico. By mid-June, the World Health Organization declared the first flu pandemic in more than four decades. Here we are 9 months later, and only seven states are currently reporting widespread flu activity. Cases continue to decline nationwide. The H1N1 crisis seems to have been averted, or maybe it was never a crisis in the first place. We've got a couple of people here to talk about it. Joan Nichols is Associate Director for Research at the Galveston National Laboratory. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Dr. D.A. Henderson is a professor of medicine and public health at the University of Pittsburgh and author of Smallpox, Death of a Disease. Dr. Henderson, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Very happy to be here.
I'll start with you, Joan Nichols. It does seem that we managed to avert this H1N1 catastrophe. Was that because we were smart or lucky?
We were both smart and lucky. At first, mostly lucky, because we discovered the virus fairly quickly, and Mexico did its best initially, once the virus was identified, to slow spread and give us some time to educate people and develop good hygiene practices and things like that. So it's a little bit of both.
And D.A. Henderson, you're a physician, you're also a public health expert, and you paint a slightly less rosy picture about how we reacted to this. Why so?
Well, I think the CDC and manufacturers did what they could in trying to make a vaccine, but this proved to be very difficult. And I think the difficulty, however, that we had was in communicating with the public on a couple of occasions and many occasions about the likelihood of what the epidemic was going to be like and when vaccine would be available. So there's a lot of misleading kinds of information, which I think confused the public.
So you're saying that the way that communication went on wasn't great, and maybe there was problems with the vaccine distribution, but do you think the decisions that were made were pretty sound?
Well, the decisions that were made were primarily related to trying to produce vaccine as rapidly as possible, and I think the decisions were made well. We just don't have a very good vaccine that we could put together quickly, and that's something that has to be corrected.
Do you think, D.A. Henderson, that it's a problem that we rely on private industry to create these vaccines when people's lives are hanging in the balance?
Well, I think this is technology that's involved, and where government and industry have to work closely together. We need a number of developments that to produce a vaccine, which can be given once and will protect at least for 3 or 4 years, so that we don't have this frantic problem of identifying a new virus and then just having months to produce large quantities of it. This has failed before in 1957 when we tried to put it together. We failed again here.
Well, it's hard to plan for a pandemic virus, and it's hard to plan for a pandemic vaccine because of the way influenza changes. We're always going to have that problem that we're going to be behind in terms of development of the vaccine to fit the virus that's circulating if it fits the type for a pandemic type, and it's a new virus that nobody has immunity to. Now, severity is a different story. Pandemic just means the potential to spread across the world because we do not have immunity in our population. So it's hard to plan for a new virus.
Joan Nichols, Associate Director for Research, Galveston National Laboratory. What is this that we hear about a possible third wave?
Well, what's happened in the past, generally when a new virus enters our population, a new influenza virus, as we see an initial seeding of the population, usually it's a little slower than we saw with this virus, but then we move faster than we have in the past in terms of moving from place to place globally. So with the fact that we seeded this virus out in our population fairly quickly, it spread through the initial first groups of people. We got some information about, good information about good hygiene practices, some social distancing. We've learned how to wash our hands more. All of those things have slowed the spread of the virus. But what will probably happen as we move into a period where we're not as worried about contamination, we're not as worried about getting the virus, we're probably going to spread it through the population in a second wave. And we'll probably see more people because, again, even though we've got a vaccine program that's starting, vaccine has only hit most states recently. And so we haven't vaccinated enough of our population to protect them to limit the spread as it moves through again. And so that's the second wave theory that happens.
Let me pose a similar question to you, D.A. Henderson. Do you feel like what we've learned from this round of H1N1 prepares us for what's ahead? Because there's always something new sort of coming down the road. And my question is, are we going to be able to handle it?
Well, I think we're going to be better prepared. There are a number of actions being taken in terms of vaccine production improvements and also a lot of work being done to develop vaccines which have a broader a protective range. What we did not learn very well is that we had a previous experience in 1957. We had a pandemic which has behaved almost like this epidemic in time and in all characteristics virtually. And at that time, we did have a winter epidemic. It went from January to March, which is the usual time when it seems best and easiest for influenza to occur. However, there's a difference this year, and that is that we've discovered that many fewer cases than were expected are occurring in people beyond 65 years of age.
Yeah.
And that's the very dangerous time.
That's D.A. Henderson, professor of medicine and public health at University of Pittsburgh and the author of Smallpox, Death of a Disease. Also, Joan Nichols was here, associate director for research at the Galveston National Laboratory.
Coming up,
I think it's time for a fresh start.
We're going to talk about how you can get a fresh start in your career and maybe take on a new direction with purpose, even if you're out of work right now. We're going to talk about that and your work life later on this hour.
I've chosen guest hosting The Takeaway.
Nice, nice path.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Luke Burbank, filling in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. All this week, we are taking a look back at some of the best of 2009. And today, we're going to look at technology and what perhaps looking ahead we may see more of in 2010. So we've got Marshall Kirkpatrick to talk about that. He's the lead writer of Read Write Web. That's a leading blog about web technology news. And his blog is syndicated by our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Marshall.
Good morning.
So, one of the leading technology innovations is social media, and probably the leader there is Facebook. And we've been hearing a lot about Facebook changing their privacy policies. What are they doing now, and how that might that evolve next year?
Oh, it's been big. Here at the end of the year, they have begun a fundamental shift in the nature of privacy on Facebook. As of just the last few weeks, for example, the group membership of all of the users on Facebook is now publicly accessible information. It used to be private all along. And the user activity data, the things that you publish, your comments, your photos, what have you, are now defaulting to public, though they can be switched over to private and visible only to the people that you've accepted friendships from. And that's a really big shift in the world's biggest social network.
And maybe tightening even more in the year ahead.
I expect that will be changing more and more. Facebook's interest really is in getting people to publish more and more of their content
and feel
publicly,
comfortable doing it,
and exposing themselves, even though the genesis of the site was very different.
Okay, so let's talk about something else that you point to. It's called data portability. What is that?
Data portability is a movement that lots of organizations around the web are working on that would enable users to take their data with them from one website out to another. It's comparable, I think, to cell phone number portability. If you remember, it was only a few years ago that once you left cell phone providers, you lost your phone number. But
was
now
that really only a few years ago?
It was only a few years ago. And similarly, right now, we spend our time on these websites like Facebook and Twitter and MySpace, and we build up really valuable assets like friends lists and expressed interests and activity, and those are locked up inside of those sites. And so data portability is a movement that would enable us to take all that information that we've built up with us out to the next site, because we can leverage that for personalization and increased new features, what have you. User data is a form of currency these days. And so there are people who are working, including many people at Facebook and Twitter, to enable users to control that currency and take it with them from one site to the next. So I expect we'll see a lot more of that in 2010.
Okay, Marshall Kirkpatrick, lead writer of Read Write Web, a leading blog about web technology news. His blog syndicated by our partner, The New York Times, talking about some of the things we may see in 2010. And one thing he didn't talk about but is also still big is the development of iPhone apps. And I imagine the iPhones and similar phones are going to become more versatile in the year.
You know,
ahead.
I have
That's
an
my
iPhone
prediction.
App. I have an iPhone app. I'll show it to you later.
Okay.
That sounded weird, but I really
it
do.
It did sound a little weird, but I'll take a look
at it.
Takes
an afternoon to set up. It's kind of amazing.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Luke Burbank, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. We talk about work on Tuesdays at The Takeaway, Luke. And the thing is when you're looking for a job, seriously, how much do you weigh the meaningfulness of that job if you just want to find work?
Depends on how much you want to pay your mortgage.
Okay, we're going to talk about that in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Iran has reacted angrily to statements from the U.S. about Sunday's violent protests in Tehran. Those protests left at least 8 people dead. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says foreign nations have a secret agenda in Iran. On Monday, President Obama condemned what he called, quote, the violent and unjust suppression of innocent Iranian citizens. Back at home, the president is ordering a probe into how terror watch lists are managed. The move comes after the failed attempt to blow up a U.S. airliner on Christmas Day.
Abroad, North Korea says it has detained an American man who illegally entered the country last week through a Chinese border. South Korean activists say American missionary Robert Park slipped across to call attention to human rights conditions. A British man, Akmal Sheikh, was executed in China early this morning for smuggling heroin into the country. He was the first European to be executed in China in over 50 years. We were joined earlier from London by Sharong Chen, the editor of the BBC's China service. I asked him who exactly was Akmal Sheikh.
This is a British man, originally resident in North London. He was arrested in Urumqi over 2 years ago with heroin on him. And the British government and his relatives, cousins and so on have been trying ever since to get him released on grounds of diminished mental responsibility.
Is this straining relations between the UK and China? It must be.
Well, I think that there is a tendency to push this case into a diplomatic row, even though the British foreign minister in charge of relations with China saying, let's not get the thing row escalated, but there is a tendency. And there's also a bipolar sort of wide divergent views on this from what we can see in the British media and the Chinese media as well. Some of the British papers have made it a kind of a human rights case, a case for diplomatic pressure on China and so on.
Thank you, Sharong Chen, editor of the BBC Chinese service. He joined us earlier from London.
It's Tuesday. It's time to talk about work on the takeaway. And New Year's is kind of an odd time, and it's when many people stop and re-examine their lives. And many people actually, during these tough economic times, have re-examined their working lives. Sometimes being without a job can be frustrating, but some people see it as an opportunity to get a fresh start. And joining us to talk about how you can combine wage earning with social purpose, we have Marcy Alverher. She's a senior fellow at the think tank that studies boomers, work, and social purpose called Civic Ventures. We're also joined by James Smallwood, who's now a union carpenter and the founder and CEO of the nonprofit group The Choice Is Yours Incorporated. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Marcy, you study baby boomers, and you've actually discovered over the course of these studies that there are people that leave their jobs and they decide to find a career that actually contributes, that gives back to their community, right?
Yeah. Celeste, we're finding at this stage of life, people want and need to continue working. We all know that. That's no surprise. But we also find that at this later stage of the career, people want to do something that matters in the world. They want to do something that's bigger than themselves.
Okay, so James, you had kind of an epiphany moment. And let's take you back to that moment of decision when you completely changed your careers. You were a successful sales manager.
Yes.
You had a troubled period in your life.
Yes.
And you emerged from that with this nonprofit, The Choice Is Yours. What motivated that change?
Well, I was on drugs. I was homeless. I went through all those changes. I was in prison and went through all of that. And I came out of prison and I got sober and I met some people and I started helping people. And I just said, God, if you give me one more chance, I will never do this again. And I will just try to follow your will. And I gave him my word that I would just keep on trying to help people.
So what does your group do?
My group right now, we train the homeless and ex-offenders in construction trades, carpentry, plumbing, electric. We partner with several colleges to get them their GED and the high school diplomas. We also have a huge job placement portion of our organization.
Marcy, you know, I'm a Buddhist, and this concept of right work, right livelihood, this is centuries old. That's part of the Eightfold Path, right? Our vocation can either broaden your compassion or it can erode it. So this concept is not necessarily new.
No. And we also think there's part of this that has to do with a life stage. You know, we go through certain life stages, and we think we get to a point where, you know, lots of people, I mean, James has an unusual story, and we honor people like James because he's an inspiration. I mean, look what he came from and what he's doing now. And many people think, well, wow, I don't know what to do. I don't know if my skills are transferable, or I just got laid off. And when you hear a story like James, doesn't that give you some sense of thinking, wow, what can I do with what I have to, as you say, just kind of do this kind of work that really matters in the world, that is bigger than yourself.
Right, but not everyone can. I mean, for James, if you're looking for work, especially in this particular climate, you're going to take whatever job you can, whether it has social purpose or not, right?
That's true. You're going to take whatever you can get, and that's why we try to offer people alternatives to what's out here right now. We know that if we can teach a person to use their hands, to a skill in 3 or 4 weeks, that they can really make a living to support their families.
And we're doing similar work at Civic Ventures. We fund community college retraining programs that are largely focused on boomers. So we're training people for fields that we think are going to be growth fields in the social services, nursing, gerontology, anything that has to do with elder care, green technology, jobs in the green economy, things that we think are both growing and that are important.
Marcia, do you feel like there's this sort of thing where people, I would call myself a sort of middle-class person, and I think of the people who are able to kind of refocus their life as either being at the top of the spectrum, like they're really rich and they're just not working for the money, or more towards the bottom, like their life has sort of fallen apart, like James did. What about people in the middle? What are you supposed to do?
Our research has shown this is happening at every socioeconomic level. So as I showed you, we're working on community college programs, but we also get called by elite universities who want us to do programs for their alumni about encore careers. We're seeing interest at all levels. And we're also seeing people who invested their careers in a money field saying, wow, look where that got me. Maybe it's time to do something else.
You know, James, let me ask you something. If you hadn't gone through that very rough period that landed you in a kind of bottom point in your life, would you have been perfectly happy staying in your successful sales manager position and earning that high wage? And
I would not have been. I had to go through what I went through, and I know it was rough for me. I suffered a lot out there with the addiction and with the crack and the whole, the alcoholism and the insanity and the whole bit. And but I am glad I went through that. That paved the way for me to be where I'm right now, to really change my life and me really want to help others who people consider to be helpless.
So Marcy, is there a way that someone, maybe they can't give up their job? There must be, like, part-time work.
Well, lots of people in encore careers are not working in the same way they worked in their primary career. Sometimes they're working flexibly. Sometimes they work part-time, which, by the way, is something that people often want to do late in their careers. They have other familial commitments, time commitments. So they're thinking, wow, I may have been able to retire. I may have been thinking, wow, I'm going to retire and maybe take it easy, do a little volunteering. We're saying, well, why don't you think about an encore career? Maybe you'll earn a little less money, but maybe you'll extend those years in which you both work and give back, and maybe you'll find some way to combine the cushion of some income with the stimulation of continued work and the good feeling of helping others.
Marcy Alwaher, Senior Fellow for Civic Ventures, and James Smallwood, who did this very thing that we're talking about. He's a union carpenter and founder of the nonprofit The Choice Is Yours, Incorporated. Thanks to both of you. If you have any advice for people who are looking for a fresh start, tell us how you did it.
My name is John. I took a part-time job that was totally out of my field. I actually ran a pump-out service, and I landed in my dream job, and this was all coming from being laid off in a totally different field. Now I'm training to get my captain's license. It's just been the best year of my life.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
As it happens, that's also how you can reach us today, because we're looking for New Year's resolutions, not for you, for America. What should the country's 2010 resolution be?
Troy from North Dakota calling. Our national New Year's resolution should be to encourage our youth to stop texting while driving. And there should be a government-run ad campaign on TV and billboards that says, texting in traffic, America's next lost generation.
What's your resolution for America? Fewer people with explosives in their pants on airplanes? Congress passing health care? Dare to dream. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
For the first time in the history of modern Iran, people are out in the streets asking, where is my vote?
Hamid Debashi, professor at Columbia University, talking about Iranian protests. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Luke Burbank. It's The Takeaway. So how exactly did a man who U.S. and British authorities were already watching climb aboard a passenger jet with his underwear full of explosive powder? And what all are we doing to make sure it doesn't happen again?
We need to determine just how the suspect was able to bring dangerous explosives aboard an aircraft and what additional steps we can take to thwart future attacks.
Billions of dollars spent and what feels like millions of hours of hassle later to airline passengers, and we may not be much safer than before. 8 years ago, it was a shoe bomb attempt, and we've been taking our shoes off ever since. Now authorities say it was an underwear bomb, meaning, oh, geez, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 29th. I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, Luke Burbank. Let's get right to the news this morning. Tough words coming from President Obama.
Those who would slaughter innocent men, women, and children must know that the United States will do more than simply strengthen our defenses. We will continue to use every element of our national power to disrupt, to dismantle, and defeat the violent extremists who threaten us.
Those words appeared geared toward a group calling itself Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which has claimed responsibility for Friday's failed attack against an airliner bound for Detroit. At the airports, passengers around the world have gone through a double screening. Even babies have been frisked at the gate. But a report this morning from our partner, the New York Times, says there are gaps in the security. It says the government has yet to find a way to efficiently match passenger names with terror watch lists. And the Times also reports that millions of dollars were squandered on faulty technology like the high-tech puffer machines that were constantly breaking down and failed to detect explosives.
We've got more on airline security right now as we're joined by Chris Yates. Chris is an aviation security analyst for Jane's. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Luke.
Does this attempted Christmas Day bombing we've been talking about so much seem like an isolated slip-up to you or maybe part of something more systemic?
You know, we would like to think that it was an isolated incident, but I've got to say that we have to be mindful there may be others out there.
Do you think this was a European problem or a United States problem where the slip-up started?
There's multiple issues here, but essentially this is a global issue with a focus on Africa, Europe, and the United States.
Wow. So everyone is implicated in this. Chris Yates, stay right there. We're going to be back with you in just a moment.
In Iran, the authorities say they're holding the bodies of five protesters killed during anti-government protests over the weekend. It's an attempt to keep the opposition from using the funerals for more protests. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Hamid Debashi of Columbia University. He was in Iran during the revolution 30 years ago and tells us things are very different now.
80% of the Iranian population is under the age of 40. 50% is under the age of 25. They neither have a memory of the revolution of 30 years ago, nor could they care less about those who do.
For its part, Iran is accusing the West of fomenting the protests.
And checking in on the markets, those Asian markets ended up. The European indices were up as well. Futures are up, and the Dow gets underway this hour. 10,547. The S&P opens at 1,127, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,291.
Later this hour, we're going to talk about what were the best tech developments of the past decade. Remember, we started this decade without really Google, without iPhones, without Facebook. We're going to talk tech later this hour. And we're also talking about New Year's resolutions, not for you, for America. What should the country's 2010 resolution be?
Hi, yes, this is Ed Helmrich from Larchmont, New York. I think our purpose for this year should be to decrease abortions by making them illegal. We need to be pro-life this year.
We also have another response from our Facebook page. This is from Jean King. She says, let's be a little more sensible and a little less bipartisan. Let us know what your resolution for the country is for 2010. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I've said I think the resolution for the country should be a fresh fruit or vegetable with every meal.
You can't go wrong with that. Also coming up, how exactly did the chain of airline security break leading up to the attempted explosion on Christmas Day? We're going to talk about that coming up in just a moment on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
In for John Hockenberry on this Tuesday, I'm Luke Burbank. President Obama paused his vacation yesterday in Hawaii to respond to the attempted Christmas Day bombing of Northwest Airlines Flight 253, telling Americans he's doing his best to keep them safe in the skies.
The American people should be assured that we are doing everything in our power to keep you and your family safe and secure.
The president also said the investigation continues into how exactly Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab was able to smuggle an explosive chemical known as PETN onto that flight from Amsterdam to Detroit. Well, color us curious as well here at The Takeaway. We were also wondering just that thing. What went wrong here? To help us get to the bottom of all this is Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
And welcoming back Chris Yates, an aviation security analyst for Jane's. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good day.
So, Chris, take us through the chain of breakdowns that eventuated in a guy on a plane over Detroit trying to light his pants on fire.
The chain of events, I think, was quite simple. You know, we don't like to think that security at airports is equal the world over, but in actual fact, it's not. This guy appears to have taken his explosive device on in Lagos, in Nigeria. He's gone through the intermediate airport, Amsterdam Schiphol, where he may not have been screened as effectively as we would hope he'd be screened. And then, as a last issue, the watch list that the United States holds on people of interest failed to match this guy with a name on that list. And hey presto, the system failed, and it failed spectacularly.
Barbara, I wanted to ask you about that list. He had been denied a visa by Britain and then was on a sort of watch list called Tide by the United States, and yet these two lists apparently weren't talking to each other. Does this really come down to a communication breakdown?
Well, yes. It also really points out the failure to really upgrade the passenger screening system. I mean, it really essentially is almost the same as we had in place on 9/11. They've been trying to do it for years, and it's been held up by a variety of factors, including some opponents in Congress and elsewhere who are concerned that better information on passengers could lead to data mining and intrusions into people's privacy. So you always have to balance those things in our society, of course. And what's happened is it's taken an incredibly long time to upgrade the system. It's in the process of being improved, but however, that didn't help on Christmas Day, unfortunately.
It seems like these lists are so problematic because just after 9/11, the lists were enormous and lots of very innocent people were being taken off of flights. And now that list has been pared down considerably, and it seems like people may be slipping through the cracks. Do you think this idea of lists is a good one? It's just about the communication, or is it a little bit impossible just on its face?
No, I think they are actually right now in the process of making it smarter. For example, there's a new system called Secure Flight, where I guess anybody who's recently booked a ticket knows you now have to give them more information. You have to give them your birth date. You have to give them your precise name as it appears on your driver's license or whatever you're using as ID. Now, what the proponents of a better system had really wanted is a lot more information on people's social security numbers and that sort of thing, and that obviously never happened. I don't think it's impossible, and in fact, in this case, really, it was just a matter of they didn't get this guy's name on the right list in time. It's really not rocket science. It just has to be better coordinated.
But Chris Yates, let me ask how it happened that it wasn't on in time. Because, I mean, we have these cell phone videos coming out of Iran. It seems like we have minute-to-minute updates coming from people's Facebook and Twitter. And yet there were so many kind of red flags that could have gone onto this guy's file, and they didn't get to the right people in time.
And I've got to tell you, the Secure Flight, in this instance, just simply doesn't work. It will never work as it stands. Whenever any of us over here in Europe travel to the United States, you want everything in terms of information, mobile phone numbers, credit card details, name, address, telephone number, almost to inside leg measurement. But yet, here you are.
Which in this case would have been particularly relevant.
This guy. That was required to be provided by the airline to the United States government prior to that aircraft taking off from Europe, and yet you failed to match the name with the name on the watch list. And therefore, the system is simply not working.
Barbara, let's talk about another part of the system, which is the actual machinery. Some people are saying that had this man gone through a puffer machine, one of those ones that blows the air on you, or one of these body scan machines, which have an X-ray and have been said to kind of show a person's naked body, those would have detected this PETN. Those have been controversial, particularly in the U.S., the scanning machines. Do you think this will cause people to change their minds on that?
Yes, I do think that will cause some of the opponents to maybe rethink that. However, let's be clear. Some of this technology doesn't work as well as it's been advertised. The puffer machines you mentioned in practice really didn't work too well. They got clogged up by dust at the airports. There was a high failure rate. So that was supposed to be the great new technology that was going to detect explosives. And secondly, the body scanners, yes, those have been held up in part by, privacy concerns. And people are fairly squeamish, I guess, about, potentially having someone see you literally stripped down to, your body. But that would probably do a lot more to detect people, hiding things on their person. But there's no 100%, foolproof system out there. I think that's what we're grappling with here. And I think there's just all of these things have flaws, and none of them are going to work 100% of the time. It has to be a combination of all these things. And back to the better intelligence that we need and better systems for matching names against lists.
Chris, the president of the U.S. is promising to tighten things up. Is there one relatively simple thing he can do to actually make air travel safer?
Certainly, I think secure flights needs a complete and total revision to make it work as effectively as was initially planned. But above and beyond that, in terms of the hardware at airports, security has to be a system of systems and incorporating all manner of equipment and methods as well. I'm talking profiling here, of course, carrying out profiles on passengers as they arrive at the airport through a series of questions, and dependent upon how they respond to those questions determines what level of additional security is applied to them. In terms of the hardware itself, well, yeah, body scanners work, and I think we need to crank in our necks a little bit and accept a little bit of less privacy for the privilege of being able to travel internationally.
Chris Yates, aviation security analyst for Jane's, thank you so much, and also Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. It's just about 15 minutes after the hour. Let's get the news headlines.
The latest Case-Shiller Index on home prices shows prices rose in October for the fifth month in a row, but the recovery seems to be uneven. Only 11 of the 20 cities tracked showed actual gains. The home price index is up 3.4% from its low point in May. And the government in Afghanistan is continuing to probe what it says was a NATO airstrike on civilians in the northeast of the country this Sunday. The government says 10 civilians, including 8 school children, were killed. President Karzai says he's dispatched a delegation to investigate the attack. Meanwhile, in a news conference this morning, a spokesman, Wahid Omar, says there was a lack of communication between Western and local forces.
The incident was not coordinated with the local authorities, were not coordinated with our forces in the area.
In Iran, more opposition activists have been arrested today. The latest roundup includes the sister of Nobel Peace Prize winner Shireen Ebadi. Meanwhile, Tehran is accusing the U.S., Britain, and other Western countries of stirring up the violence.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, when attempted terrorism happens in the United States, what response do American Muslims play? We're going to talk about their response to this one, which is to protest about peacefulness. That's coming up.
Hey, you want that to go?
Celeste Headley here with Luke Burbank. Good morning, Luke. This is the time when we do some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. And the first one comes from Dearborn, Michigan. The terror suspect who tried to blow up a Northwest Airlines flight en route to Detroit on Christmas Day is scheduled for a court hearing next week. But we got this message from President Obama very clear. The U.S. will do more to secure our defenses.
Those who would slaughter innocent men, women, and children must know that the United States will do more than simply strengthen our defenses. We will continue to use every element of our national power to disrupt, to dismantle, and defeat the violent extremists who threaten us.
But the attempt on a Christmas Day didn't just motivate President Obama for tough words. It also motivated Majid Mughni. He's an attorney in Dearborn, Michigan. Dearborn, of course, is home to 30,000 Arab Americans, the largest Muslim population in the United States. Good morning, Majid.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. You are organizing through Facebook and other online media a demonstration against this act of terrorism. Explain.
We're asking for a massive demonstration. You know, we live in this country. We love this country. America is a country of freedom and fortunes. America is the greatest country that has ever been on the face of the earth. Terrorists, under the disguise of Muslims, have basically attacked America on so many occasions. Since September 11, Muslims have cried out and said, these terrorists are not part of us. Well, for the past 8 years, what have Muslim communities done to take action? Well, action speaks louder than words. They've taken no action for 8 years. Well, it's time for us to take action. We have these terrorists who systematically attempted to bomb an airliner right over the heads of the largest Muslim population in the country. And these terrorists, well, I think it's an attack on Muslims as well as an attack on America. It's time that we Muslims stand up and say enough is enough. If you want to kill Americans, come kill us first. If you want to assassinate Americans, come assassinate us. If you want to blow up Americans, come blow us up first. We'll be on the front lines. We'll be in front of the world media. As the media rolls into town, we'll be standing there. You can see our faces. Come kill us if you want to kill Americans. Stay away from peaceful, loving Americans, innocent Americans.
You know, you say that Muslims haven't taken any action since September 11th, but there have been clerics who've stepped forward and argued about the peaceful nature of the Islamic faith.
Action speaks louder than words. For 8 years, no one has taken action. These terrorists have had a free ride for 8 years, and we, as Muslims in this country, have been lying down like playing dead for 8 years. It's time that we wake up and we tell these terrorists, we want you out of the civilized world. We will do whatever it takes to eliminate you because we believe in peace, and what you're doing is not peaceful. If we can save one life, one American life, by our peaceful protest, our religion teaches us you save one life as if you saved the entire human race. And these terrorists, when one of them gets up in an airplane and attempts to kill 300 people, they do not stand for our religion.
You've said that you feel like the terrorists have hijacked the peaceful Muslim faith. I'm wondering, what are you hoping the protests will do?
We're hoping the protests ignites the entire Muslim world against these guys, against these terrorists, and lets them know that we're not going to fall for their trap. If they're trying to create chaos in America, well, the chaos is going to be created against them. We're going to be after them. We're going to be the ones on the front line. We're going to be attacking them. We're going to get them out of our mosques. We're going to get them out of our schools. We're going to get them out of our homes. We're going to eliminate these people.
Okay, Majid Mughni, attorney in Dearborn, organizer of some upcoming demonstrations. You can get more information about that online.
For our last takeout, we're going to turn it over to you, the listeners. Some of you had some pretty interesting takes on the fallout from the airline safety questions, to put it mildly, that happened just recently. Here was one from Dan.
The new airline regulations about when you can access your carry-on bags and things you can use and, you know, within 1 hour of destination, totally ridiculous. So you do it an hour and a half before your destination. It just makes no sense.
Lydia from New York wrote on our website, thetakeaway.org. She says, there's a reactive approach rather than a preemptive approach. The only way I'd feel safe is not with the reactive window dressing at airport security checkpoints, but with a concerted intelligence effort designed for early identification.
Now, Troy from North Dakota has a more, you could say, proactive idea.
Based on conversations I've had and things that I've observed in the news, I don't think people feel safe. And in a way, I think that's a good thing because, proven by this last incident, somebody was ready or, you know, rose to the occasion to take the bad guy down. And I think that's what you need to be ready for. It may sound silly, but if you fly, expect the worst and be ready to help take the bad dude out.
I want to be sitting next to Troy.
Yeah, no kidding.
Next, when the you-know-what hits the fan. Also, we got an email from someone named Knock One Man. He said, they are just toying with our minds. Why else would they use a device that doesn't work. Why did these guys try to set it off in their seats when they could have locked themselves in the bathroom? What's your take on airline safety? And did you see anything different at the airport of late? Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Does taking out the bad guy, does that include the guy who like elbows me through the whole flight?
I think that would be probably an overly aggressive interpretation of Troy's wishes.
All this week, we're also asking you about your New Year's resolutions for 2010.
This is Jeannie from Mansfield, Massachusetts, and my New Year's resolution is to see the best in every situation, not to pick out the worst, not to feel so defensive, and to refrain from vengeance behavior.
Jeannie, that is a nice resolution.
She sounds like our bomb expert, Jimmy.
What New Year's resolution do you have planned for 2010, and do you have any strategies that actually help you stick to resolutions? Most people can't. We want your painfully honest stories of resolutions gone bad. Also, call us at 877-8 My Take or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, what's the worst that could happen if you avoid the census?
The question is, do we keep our 8 congressional seats or do we lose a congressional seat?
We're going to talk about the implications for Minnesotans, which are huge, in just a few minutes. Coming up, nobody really likes paperwork, right? But you can lose a lot, actually, if you avoid the paperwork of filling out your census survey. There's a lot on the line, real things. We're going to talk about how that might play out in Minnesota in a few minutes. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. A group calling itself Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is claiming responsibility for Friday's failed attack against the airliner bound for Detroit. The internet statement claims that the Nigerian suspect, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, coordinated with the group while he was in Yemen. President Obama says the U.S. will go after them.
A full investigation has been launched into this attempted act of terrorism, and we will not rest until we find all who were involved and hold them accountable.
Security has been tightened at airports, both here at home and around the world. In some cases, passengers are being screened twice, and there are increased numbers of marshals on planes. The worry is sending some airline stocks down. Delta down 4.3%, American down more than 4%, and Continental is down almost 3%. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to airline consultant Robert Mann.
We're always subject to these external geopolitical factors, and that may win or lose the day.
He says the economic outlook for airlines, though, still remains good. Meanwhile, Canadian officials have taken this step.
U.S.-bound passengers are not allowed to bring carry-on bags into the cabin of the aircraft.
Air Transport Canada spokeswoman Deborah Baxter, she says only small items like purses and laptops will be allowed on U.S.-bound flights.
Italian news reports say a bomb experts have detonated a suspicious package that was found at Milan's Malpensa airport. The parcel had been abandoned in the check-in area of the terminal. An Italian news agency says the package was equipped with a detonator and a radio receiver, although it said it wasn't clear if there were also explosives. Here at home, Tiger Woods' domestic problems are apparently being felt by the companies he endorses. Two University of California researchers looked at stock market returns for the 13 days after the golf star's crash. They say the total losses for shareholders at those companies comes close to $12 billion. Before the scandal broke, Tiger was earning about $100 million a year in endorsements. Speaking of those markets, the Dow is up about 20 points, the S&P is up about 2, and the NASDAQ is up about 3. Those are just some of the stories we're following this morning.
All this week, we're taking a look at the 2010 census and the communities that stand to lose the most if they're not counted. We always know that every census time comes around every 10 years, and especially minority activists are out there trying to mobilize their community, Latino communities, Native Americans, non-English speakers, but they're trying to mobilize a new minority community. That would be the people of Minnesota. Minnesotans could suffer some serious consequences if they don't fill out their census forms this year. They could lose a congressional seat. To explain this, we're joined by Tom Scheck. He's been reporting on this for Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Celeste.
I want to play a clip from an interview you did with Tom Gillespie, the Minnesota State Demographer.
The question is, do we keep our 8 congressional seats or do we lose a congressional seat? And up until this last year, the bet was a little bit more than 50-50 against us. Now it's a little bit better than 50-50 right now that we would keep that 8th seat.
So, Tom, why are you guys in danger of losing a congressional seat?
Well, Celeste, it's almost like a game of musical chairs every 10 years where there's a,
The Census Bureau takes all these population numbers, and then what happens is Congress has to reapportion seats. So every state in Congress gets one congressional seat, and then they divvy up the other 385 based on population. Minnesota right now has 8 seats, but based on the population estimates and the projections moving forward, it looks like they're going to be the last state out. So they would be the 386th state in terms of that population, which means they would have to lose a seat and then get 7 seats.
Have you lost population?
They aren't losing population. They just aren't growing as quickly as other states. Uh-huh. Minnesota gained about 35,000 people between 2008 and 2009. And when they project out and look, okay, well, let's take a gander and see what's going to happen in July of 2010. When that census is taken, what ends up happening is they say states that are fast growing, Nevada, Florida, Arizona, those types of states are going to gain population faster than Minnesota. This has been a trend that has been going on where states in the Northeast and in the upper Midwest, population hasn't been growing as quickly because a lot of folks have been moving west and to the south.
So, you know, people often don't really pay too much attention to the census. It's always a struggle to get people to fill out their census surveys. But something that people should remember is that they set federal funding amounts based on census population numbers. Can you tell me what kind of funding are we talking about? What kind of programs?
Well, it's billions and billions of dollars, and it's based on two things. I mean, there's money for schools and there's money for health care that's gets divvied up in terms of this pie. I think the pie is about $380 billion. So they base those numbers on population. So if you're going to get money for schools, if you're in Minnesota and you're perhaps the 386th state, you're going to see less money than another state like Arizona, Nevada, that is growing more quickly. The other thing that happens is states with a lot of more political clout, members of Congress get to write laws, and they say, okay, well, we're going to set dairy formulas. We're going to set other Medicare pricing going on. You're hearing about the healthcare debate. Now, what ends up happening is if you have fewer members of Congress, you have less political clout to make your argument when you go to the Hill.
So one thing that I found ironic is that the housing crash in some way is benefiting Minnesota. You have so many snowbirds there that leave for the warmer climates during the winter. And in Minnesota, there's a drive to get them back to Minnesota to fill out their census survey. This is William Frey, someone you spoke to from the Brookings Institute.
In the mid part of this decade, there were some very hot parts of the country. Hot because they had easy loans, affordable homes, places like Las Vegas, Phoenix, Orlando, other parts of the Sun Belt were just attracting migrants in droves.
But after the housing crash, there's fewer people leaving the state during those winter seasons, and that's going to help up the census count there, right?
Well, just to correct that a little bit, there's two things going on. There's the snowbird issue, and then there's also this issue where people aren't moving as much as they were in the past. They said it's the slowest migration that's been going on since World War II. So what ends up happening is, you know, Nevada, Florida, Arizona, the Carolinas, those states were projected in the middle part of the decade to move rather quickly. A lot of people were going to move there by the end of the decade. Those were the projections. Now they're seeing, because people can't sell their houses and they can't find a job, they're not leaving as quickly. That's one of the concerns. The other concern that's happening is Minnesota notices, if anyone ever looks at a weather map in December, January, February, it's really cold in Minnesota, and a lot of retirees
really?
Say,
you don't say.
Yes, it's like 5 degrees
me,
right
sir.
Now. So folks are just like, I'm not staying in Minnesota. I'm going to Florida. I'm going to Arizona. What they're finding, though, is that the way the census is going to be done this year is they send out these envelopes that have barcodes on them. So if these snowbirds who live 8-9 months in Minnesota fill out their census form in March or April when they're in Arizona or the other southern state, what they're going to find is that the census is going to be taken, that those folks are going to be recognized in Arizona because of that barcode, or Florida, wherever. And what the folks in Minnesota are doing is saying, you know what, don't fill out your census form while you're living there. Wait till you come back during Easter, April, whenever, and then fill it out there, because then you could be counted in Minnesota.
You know, Minnesota's dealing with the same problem everywhere, which is that people have a hard time making the census a priority. Do the people in Minnesota realize what's at stake?
They do, and Minnesota has traditionally been counted Very accurately. One of the things they say is there's not that big of an undercount. North Carolina, South Carolina, there are other states where they don't count as many people as they should. In Minnesota, they do have this civic pride. They usually have the highest rate of voter participation in the state, so they do recognize that. But it comes down to right now about 1,100 people. They're about 1,100 people short of Missouri for that last congressional seat.
That's taking
it. Every person matters.
That's taking it down to the wire. Tom Scheck is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks so much. Coming up, we're going to look back on what the past decade meant for technology. Remember when 10 years ago there was no iPhone or Facebook? Most people didn't know what Google was. It's been a big 10 years in technology. We'll look back and forward later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Luke Burbank, filling in for John Hockenberry. He'll be back next week. The chemical that Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab unsuccessfully attempted to detonate on that Northwest Airlines flight was something called PETN. Now, this is the same stuff that Richard Reed, a.k.a. the shoe bomber, was trying to light back in 2001 when he was in that plane over the Atlantic. That is pretty much 0-for-2 for the PETN when it comes to high-profile bombing attempts. So why is it the explosive of choice for these aspiring terrorists? Jimmy Oxley is a professor of chemistry at the University of Rhode Island. Her specialty is explosives. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Luke.
So what exactly is PETN anyway?
Incidentally, it stands for pentaerythritol tetranitrate, in case you wanted to know that.
That has actually made it somehow more confusing for me. What's this stuff actually do?
It's a nitrate ester, and it is a high explosive, a sensitive high explosive. With a detonator, it's very easy to initiate. I would guess, and I might be wrong, that the reason you see it in both cases is because it's rather available anywhere there's explosives. There's usually PETN found in detonating cords.
So it's actually pretty easy to get. Is it easy to buy it by itself, or you're just saying it can be sort of harvested from something?
I'm thinking of acquired, yes, or harvested maybe. It is almost in any set of explosives, military, commercial, EOD, there's PETN available.
Why did this guy Abdulmutallab's alleged attempt to detonate this PETN, why did it fail?
He was not using a detonator, which is the conventional way of initiating PETN. It sounds like he was trying to do some sort of chemical initiation, which is not impossible, but is also not easy.
Forgive me for my ignorance, but is a detonator something that's really large? Why wouldn't he bring a detonator onto the plane? Would it probably get caught by security?
No, detonators can be fairly small. A traditional commercial detonator would be about the size of a cigarette, but encased in aluminum. So it'd be picked up on the metal detector or some sort of an X-ray scan.
Now, if it is as challenging as it is to detonate, aside from it just being kind of readily available, is there any other reason why both of these guys, in the case of the most recent one, allegedly tried to use PETN? PETN?
It is a sensitive explosive, and they may think it was the most likely to be initiated chemically rather than by the traditional means.
Jimmy Oxley,
yes?
A professor of chemistry at the University of Rhode Island, specializing in explosives. Thank you very much for coming on The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Luke Burbank.
Hi, Celeste.
Filling in for John Hockenberry. Hey there, Luke.
So eager that I interrupted you.
Yeah, that's okay.
I'm excited.
We're going to be looking back at this past decade all this week and also looking forward to the years ahead and what may be coming. And in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about technology in the past 10 years and in 2010. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. A group calling itself Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is claiming responsibility for Friday's failed attack against an airliner bound for Detroit. President Obama says the U.S. will go after the terrorist group. And in Latin America has its first gay marriage. An official in Argentina says two men were married there yesterday. Gay marriage is still illegal in Argentina, but this was a special concession for the provincial government.
Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
This is the last week of the decade. All this week, as I said, we're looking at how our lives have been changed in the past 10 years, and technology has got to be part of this conversation.
To get any question answered instantly is one of the promises of the Internet. And Google is a search engine that delivers almost every time.
The first hit almost always includes exactly what you want.
Now, this is a quantum leap because it could take your whole music library with you right in your pocket, right in your pocket.
Boom.
In your pocket.
That's iPod.
Users are now in control of what they watch and when they want to watch it.
Fewer and fewer people are getting information from TV sets.
Immediately after the events took place, blogs were created, and they became a major part of the news environment, of the news environment, of news and news.
There was no Hulu. There was no iPhone when this decade began. We now have our technology contributors, Baratunde Thurston and Clive Thompson, here to give us the takeaway from the last 10 years of tech news. Baratunde hosts Popular Science's Future Of on the Science Channel, and Clive's a contributor to Wired Magazine. I realize I'm giving you guys an impossible task here. I mean, we don't generally know what were the most important inventions until like 50 to 100 years later. But Baratunde, what do you see as the most important innovation of the past decade?
I'd start with the mobile phone. It has changed both our definition of rudeness and lowered the bar dramatically for how that works, but it's also connected us in ways that seem costless in so many different ways. The fact that we can pull out a device almost anywhere in the world, and certainly everywhere in the developed world, and communicate with loved ones and despised ones alike, whether we're in line, whether we're at home, whether it's 2 a.m. or 2 p.m., it's changed our connection to one another, and it's a really big deal.
And text messaging, a big part of that, where you can even talk to somebody when you can't reach them on the phone.
That's right.
Yeah. Clive?
Yeah, and the other thing about mobile phones is that they got cameras. Now, this is a very big deal because what that did was it massively increased the amount of things that have been photographed. Because before you had camera phones, you had to think to carry a camera with you, and most people didn't. Once you put a camera in a phone, everyone's carrying a camera, and so the amount of things being photographed have exploded. I'll give you an example. About 2 years ago, the sort of aeronautic formation flyers were flying over Brooklyn, and I was looking at them, I thought, well, I should take a picture of that. That's really pretty. And then I thought, you know what? Someone already has.
Yeah.
And I went to Flickr, and sure enough, about 10 different people had taken pictures on their camera phones, really good pictures, and posted them. And so we're in this very fascinating world where photography has become part of everyday life because of the camera phone, and to a certain extent because Flickr has encouraged us socially to share those photos. And that itself is an incredibly big transformation, because if you think back 10, 15 years ago, the most obnoxious thing someone could do was to sit down and force you to look at their photos of their vacation.
It's true.
Or
the
their
slides.
Babies.
That's right, their
the
slides.
Baby
right.
Photos that
and,
work.
And Flickr, so Flickr changed that because it allowed us to do it voyeuristically, not to do it when someone sits us down, but to do it, you know, at our desk without them
when
there.
When we're seeking it out.
Right. And so these, I'll just finish, these two things are symbiotic. Flickr was the answer to which camera phones was the question, and camera phones were the answer to which Flickr was the question.
Huh. So, are you going with the mobile phone being the invention of the first decade of the 21st
yeah,
century?
Yeah, I'm totally going with that one. It's a big one.
Well, you know, before this decade,
yeah.
Google was not proliferating.
That's right.
There's a huge number of medical inventions that have changed the way we care for one another.
Viagra changed everything.
I wasn't going to go there, but Baratunde Thurston did indeed. Speaking of Viagra, yeah. We didn't have the kind of medical prescription ads that we did before now, which has definitely changed hospitals. What else are people going to be looking back on during the 21st century where they'll say, well, that's the year we got?
You know, I want to go back to Clive's, because I think he talked about, you know, the question and the answer of Flickr versus mobile phones. And you mentioned the word, but to Google, right, became a verb in this decade. And while Google did exist before this decade started, it certainly came into its own and changed our relationship to knowledge in the same way that Flickr and camera phones changed our relationship to photos. We don't need to know things anymore.
We need to
know how to access things, you know, how to discover and to find. And so we've outsourced a big chunk of our brains to search engines and primarily to Google. We arbitrate arguments now with, wait, I'll just Google that. We don't, you know, memorizing phone numbers, there's the address book, but all sorts of facts and figures and lots of personal information is trusted to this outsourced third-party brain.
I would argue argue, Baratunde, that that doesn't necessarily, some people would think that was a bad thing, that people don't memorize things, but to a certain extent, it's moved the conversation from just knowing facts, sometimes trivial facts, to the analyzation of that knowledge. Getting the knowledge, the specifics in and of itself is so easy now that everyone can blog about them. They can be deep thinkers about certain sites because they've gone beyond the basic threshold of what are the facts. Clive?
That's true. The comparison point that Gordon Bell makes, and he's the guy who has experimentally tried to record everything that happens to him so that he doesn't have to remember anything. And I asked him this question, does it degrade the way you deploy your memory to have constant recall out there? And he said, well, he goes, in one sense you could say it does because I don't bother remembering a lot of things. But to say that it degrades your memory is the same thing as to say, well, you know, everyone knows how to do long division, but we don't do it because we have calculators. Now, does that degrade our understanding of the world? Probably not. It just means we're free to do other things with our brains.
I mean, I have to ask you about social networking sites. I mean, although I don't think in 50 years we're still going to have MySpace and Facebook, or for that matter, Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent, this is probably something that we're going to look back at the beginning of this century, is that this is when we really started using social networking as the way we relate to our families and our friends.
And strangers.
And
celebrities, like strange people that were sort of just, well, I want to know about them. Yeah, exactly. I
mean, this is, you know, what social networks online have done is really sort of quantify and mark down in a sort of tangible fashion these soft connections that we've had. Our personal connections used to be limited by our brain's evolved ability to manage them, which is somewhere around 150 simultaneous connections. And time also acted as a separator between us and other people. So I'm not close to my kindergarten friends because I don't remember them. I'm not close to my grade school friends because I don't remember them. Social networking collapses both time and the mental limits and says you can be connected to everybody across time and space in a way that you never were able to before.
You said that Twitter and Facebook may not be here, and I think that's true. But I can tell you one thing that will probably be here in some format that was not invented by Twitter and Facebook, but definitely brought mainstream, is the status update. The idea that it is compelling and interesting to constantly, and I define constantly as anywhere from 50 times a day to once a week, to constantly broadcast to the world, be that your friends or interested strangers, what you're doing or thinking or seeing. Now this had existed in tech circles going back decades. There were these things known as the plan file.
Yeah, finger
and plan. Yeah, plan file. We're betraying our age here. But you know, if you're working on a software project, every day you would type a little paragraph and other people could ping it and see what it was. But the status update has radically changed the way we manage all those connections, because you're able to just have this very ambient in the corner of your attention span knowledge of what people are doing.
Well, it does sound like the first decade of the 21st century is going to be about what happens to us on our keyboards. No big surprise there. Baratunde Thurston, Takeaway Tech contributor. He also hosts Popular Science's Future Of on the Science Channel, and Clive Thompson is author of the science and technology blog Collision Detection. If the Takeaway is still here in 50 years, I'm going to check back with you guys and see if you're right. Thanks so much to both of you. If you listeners have a pick for the top tech innovation of the past decade and what we should be watching for, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
That is also how you can reach us today, because we're looking for your New Year's resolutions, not for you, for this fine land we call America. What should the country's 2010 resolution be?
My name's Gary. I'm in Detroit, Michigan. I would like to see the mortgage companies of America cut everybody's mortgage in half, from the biggest to the smallest. Be fair to one and all.
And Nick emails us, our resolution should be to come to grips with the fact that we all now live in a nation that's practiced and used torture on an institutional basis. Nobody was held accountable, and apparently very few people are willing to take a look under the collective rug. It's all been swept under. Shame on us all. Kind of throws cold water on the New Year's party. No? Yes.
Indeed. Diane writes to us on Facebook, let's afford every man and woman the same civil rights.
What's your resolution for the country? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm Luke Burbank. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.